Finally, a few words about the Masters. If you are a golf fan, as millions of people are, then this weekend's tournament was one to watch. It had everything. The lead changed hands several times. Underdogs were in the hunt, including 60-year-old Tom Watson. And there was a nice guy's finish first result, with veteran golfer Phil Mickelson winning his third green jacket. And, of course, there was the whole Tiger drama. The golf commentators were predictably discreet about it, but there's no point in pretending that a big part of interest in the event was anything other than finding out whether Tiger Woods, just back from his self-imposed five-month exile of shame, would be able to come back, compete effectively, and even possibly win. For those of you who've been living in exile on a small TV-free island, Tiger has been virtually invisible since he crashed his car last November, evidently to escape the wrath of his wife, Elin, in response to what quickly became known as Tiger's flagrant and ongoing involvement with other women, a story that has provided no small amount of fodder for commentators of every sort, including this one. Well, Tiger did not disappoint athletically and as a ratings draw. He came in fourth, and although his play did disappoint him, his obvious unease and relief at the fans' eager reception made him seem vulnerable and, dare I say it, human in a way that his bionic golf man persona often does not. He did show a bit of that famous Tiger peak, but commented that concern about how his personal life was affecting his play was, quote, overblown. And who can really say one way or the other? So now that we've fixated enough on how Tiger's behavior affected one woman, his wife, or even the however many women Tiger fooled around with, let's talk about how his sport, and particularly the club that hosted this premier golfing event, treats all women. For all the tiptoeing around about Tiger's marital problems, there was no discussion about the fact that Augusta National Golf Club, the host of the Masters, still refuses to admit women as full members. This was a big story back in 2002 when an activist named Martha Burke, who then headed a consortium of women's advocacy groups, raised this as an issue. Martha Burke pointed out that some 15% of the club's members are CEOs, many of Fortune 500 companies, and that refusing to admit women as members to a club that hosts one of the sporting world's premier events sends a signal that this form of discrimination is still acceptable. Can I just tell you, Burke had a point then, and the point still stands. As of the latest list published by Fortune magazine, some 15 women are CEOs of Fortune 500 companies. Finally, one of them is an African-American woman, Ursula Burns, of Xerox. And while I generally believe that comparing our scars is a pointless and meaningless exercise, it is truly hard to imagine that a major American sporting event would be held at a venue that explicitly excluded blacks, Jews, or members of any ethnic or racial group. And Augusta's refusal to allow the top tier of American businesswomen access to their hallowed membership roles tells all girls in this country that yet another door remains closed to them solely because of their gender. Augusta's policy has been defended by all manner of people, starting with Augusta's then-chairman, Hootie Johnson, who defended his club's exclusionary policy by saying that his group had the legal and, quote, moral right to organize any way they wish, and that he found Burke's public criticism, quote, offensive and coercive. And many criticized Burke by arguing that most people have more important things on their minds than whether wealthy women get to join an exclusive country club. To this I say that people who have 6 hours on a sunny weekend to chase a little white ball around also have plenty of time to ponder the finer points of social equity. And since when have the privileged and entitled responded to anything other than coercion of one sort or another? As for offensive, which is more offensive? Tiger running around on his wife, activists raising questions, or a major American enterprise acting as if half the population does not exist? And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. Today in your health, two stories about the ER. An emergency doctor looks back at a patient he wouldn't give up on, but whose family did. And our reporter talks about treating asthma to keep kids out of the ER. 3 to 4 million American children have persistent wheezing, coughing, and shortness of breath. Doctors say if they were treated for their allergies, their asthma might improve as well. NPR's Joanne Solberner reports from Atlanta.
It's a spring day in Atlanta, sunny, breezy, and full of pollen. Carla Denham has driven her daughter, Abby, 3.5 hours from their home in South Georgia.
Abby for Dr. Jamal.
They've come to an asthma and allergy clinic at Emory University.
Hey, Miss Abby, how are you doing today?
4-year-old Abby bounces in on her pink and white sneakers.
I'm going to be taking your blood pressure and your temperature today, okay?
Before going into the exam room to see Abby, her doctor, Karen DeMuth, talks about something that bothers her no end, that even though studies show 90% of children with asthma also have allergies, many doctors don't look for allergies in asthmatic kids.
All they can see is somebody who coughs and wheezes. The reason they cough and wheeze can be very hard to figure out.
Before Abby first saw Dr. DeMuth, she had drugs for asthma flare-ups and medicine for her skin allergy, eczema. But no one had diagnosed her respiratory allergies. Karen DeMuth did allergy tests. She reviews the results.
These are dust mites up here. These ones with the strange names, those are molds. House dust mites. Cat, dog, cockroach, tree pollens, grass pollens, and weed pollens.
And then she goes in to see how Abby's been doing. Abby giggles as her mom tells Dr. DeMuth that she's thrilled with how things are going. Abby now runs and plays without getting winded and no more nightly coughing.
Even the way that she looks, you just see a difference in her face. Her eyes look so much brighter.
Her mom's been working to keep Abby away from dogs and cats and anything else she's allergic to. Dr. DeMuth has her on nasal sprays for her allergy symptoms and inhalers for her asthma. Now, there's much less risk than before of a flare-up getting so bad that it would mean a trip to the emergency room. According to one asthma expert, studies show that allergies are a very important factor in ER visits and that at least a third of U.S. kids with asthma are not evaluated for their allergies. Stephen Teach of Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C. says it's worse at his hospital.
The vast majority of inner-city children have not had a comprehensive evaluation for allergies.
And that's just the first of many obstacles. Allergies can be difficult to diagnose. Allergy tests aren't always accurate, and doctors need to take a full history to learn what the child is exposed to. And if allergies are found, there's the question of how to treat. Allergy shots take several years and don't always work. One clear solution, teaching families how to avoid the things that cause the allergy. But Teach says that's hard to deliver, especially because most insurance doesn't pay for extensive counseling or home visits.
And, you know, primary care doctors have a limited amount of time to spend with families, and we estimate that it takes probably about 60 to 90 minutes to provide the kind of comprehensive education that families require to really develop a sophisticated understanding of the disease.
The good news is that education does make a difference. In one major study, researchers worked closely with several hundred families to allergy-proof their homes, getting rid of allergens like dust and cockroaches, and getting tobacco smoke out, too. That cut 21 days off of each kid's annual total of wheezy days. And best of all, a study where parents were taught to protect their kids from allergens and tobacco smoke reduced the number of emergency room visits by 30%. Dr. DeMuth is proud of the hard work Abby and her mom are doing on her allergy and asthma. She's had no asthma flare-ups and no ER visits.
We'll see you in 3 months. You guys have done awesome together.
Joanne Silberner, NPR News, Atlanta.
The world leaders attending the Washington summit will be looking for ways to limit the spread of nuclear arms and the weapons-grade material used to make those bombs. But there is a related concern about a new technology that could make it much easier to secretly refine uranium for bombs. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
Right now, the technology to enrich uranium for nuclear weapons is big and cumbersome. Typically, countries build enormous centrifuge plants. And Francis Slakey, a physicist at Georgetown University, says it's relatively easy to catch wind of a project like that.
If somebody's trying to build a covert plant to enrich uranium, they're going to have to move a lot of dirt. We're going to see that with our satellites. They're going to have to feed it a lot of power. So we're either going to see power lines going in, we're going to see the construction of a dedicated power plant, or maybe it's going to even just glow and our infrared sensors can pick it up.
So Slakey is nervous about a new technology that's been developed to enrich uranium. It's intended to make fuel for nuclear power plants, but it could be used for weapons too. This technology uses lasers to separate out the desired isotope of uranium.
It has a lot of appeal, just from physics terms.
But the downside is a laser-based enrichment plant can be much smaller and use much less electricity. And that could make a clandestine operation much harder to detect, he says.
That's the worry. Things are starting to get so small and so efficient that it's below the detection limit, which creates an enormous proliferation challenge.
More than a dozen nations have tried at one time or another to develop laser enrichment technologies, Slicky says. Most gave up, but an Australian company called Silex has apparently succeeded. That technology has been licensed to General Electric Hitachi in the United States, and that company has applied for a license from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to build a plant. In a recent opinion piece in Nature magazine, Slakey and a colleague at UC Irvine asked the NRC to do something it doesn't normally do, that is, decide whether to scuttle a technology altogether because of its proliferation risks.
Both my co-author and I are advocates of nuclear power. We're strongly in favor of nuclear power, but we think it's in the best interests of expansion of nuclear power to manage very carefully the proliferation risks.
GE Hitachi declined interview requests for this story, but in emailed comments, the company said the NRC should not judge proliferation risks as part of its licensing process. The company says it already has the go-ahead from other federal agencies that deal with proliferation. But NRC Chairman Greg Yoxko says his agency has national security responsibilities.
It's a very new technology or a novel technology. It's not similar to the kinds of enrichment facilities we've licensed in the past. So I certainly think that there may be some things there that we need to take a look at and make sure that we've got the right approach to ensuring that kind of protection of the technology and the material.
Yoxko said the review would focus on whether the company's security measures are adequate to protect the secrets of the technology. That's a more limited question than asking whether the technology is inherently risky and simply shouldn't be developed at all. The NRC has not historically considered such sweeping questions and is cautious about starting that now.
We don't necessarily want to be changing the rules in the middle of the game, but we also want to make sure that we've looked at all the issues and properly addressed it.
But Francis Slakey at Georgetown doubts whether strong security measures alone will be adequate in this case.
There's been a number of different technologies to enrich uranium. Every single one of them, despite best efforts to keep secrets, every single one of them has proliferated.
This one will eventually spread as well, he figures, but it's likely to take a lot longer if no legitimate user presses forward to perfect it in the first place. Richard Harris, NPR News.